Welcome to the Thursday, April 11th, 2019 edition of the Clemson Dubcast. Hope everybody's had a great week. Busy week at TigerIllustrated.com for Paul Strelo, of course, all the great recruiting coverage and info he provides. For me, boy, one of the most powerful stories I've ever been privileged to tell, the story of Brent Venables told in his own words. We have had that in four parts. The fourth part, if it's not out right now, upon your listening, it'll be out soon. And then on Friday, just to wrap up the series, to have kind of a nice little bow on top, we've got another cool angle from the Brent Venables story and some really colorful insight into what led him to finally share his story. Not to us, he actually shared it a couple of years ago to a group in the upstate. And that is actually how we caught wind of it about a year later. So anyway, if you are not already a subscriber to TigerIllustrated.com, never a better time than right now. The best $10 a month you'll ever spend.
The title sponsor of the Clemson Dubcast is Parham Smith and Archenhold Law Firm in Greenville. Blake Smith and Brooke Archenhold, both Clemson grads, huge fans. They are also responsible for those Clemson Dubcast koozies you might have seen floating around. I actually handed out plenty of those a few days ago in Spartanburg over at the Freight Yard. Really appreciate them doing that. Also, the forte of their firm is medical negligence. They represent patients and their family members in medical negligence actions. Also handle all sorts of other complex personal injury litigation. For instance, they handled the Cleveland Park rollover case. Also handled the GHS infection cases. Very complex stuff that they're highly trained to do. And they're in the business to help people. They offer free consultations at Parham Smith and Archenhold. So give them a call, 864-990-4581.
If you're a business owner in Clemson, Greenville, South Carolina, the Southeast, anywhere, you probably want to hear about Tandem Payment and what they have to offer. If your business accepts credit cards, you probably need to see what these guys are all about. Tandem Payment, based right here in the upstate, changing the face of payment processing, quickly becoming the most cost-effective solution for all small businesses. Tandem's program, which is based on applying a small customer service charge to each transaction, ends up saving your business up to 90% of previous processing charges. One of the owners of Tandem is a 2005 Clemson grad. Instead of entrusting the majority of your hard-earned money to someone over the phone, you can meet face-to-face with the Tandem representatives and their consultative approach. So give them a call at 864-672-1570 or online at tandempayment.com. Okay, let's get to our interview with the state's Matt Connolly. Matt and I hooked up on Tuesday, I guess, late morning over at the Abernathy Boutique Hotel in one of their nice, quiet little conference rooms. The general manager over there, Gary Cohen, wanted me to let you know they are on the hunt for certain Taps yearbooks. They've got a lot of them over there at Taps Bar and Cafe, but they're missing some. So if you have some old editions of the Taps yearbook, give them a call at the Abernathy. And if you have numerous ones that they don't have, they will give you some significant discounts on a bar tab over at Taps Bar and Cafe. Okay, here we go. Enjoy. Okay, here with Matt Connolly of the state newspaper. Matt, I feel bad because we're sitting here at the Abernathy Hotel, and normally I have a beer sitting in front of me and my guest, but it's before noon on a Tuesday. I don't know if that would be a good look.
Yeah, that's probably a little early. I'll have to come back and have one with you some other time.
All right. So I guess since this is fresh in our minds, we just left Brad Brownell's routine postseason wrap-up. And I guess the most notable thing, it's not a huge deal, but the most notable thing in the immediate aftermath is him taking exception to a question that you asked about the state of the program. I have a terrible memory. First of all, there was nothing wrong with the question. But how did you Do you remember exactly how you phrased the question?
Yeah, it said something like, just with everything you guys are losing and the pieces you have coming back and what you're bringing in, just how do you feel about kind of the state of the program right now and where you guys are? And, yeah, he didn't seem overly thrilled with my phrasing of the question.
I mean, I think that's fair. It's what everybody's wondering. Maybe there's some, I don't know, ulterior motive, but maybe he's just, I mean, I remember Dabo back in 2011, mm-hmm. after they won the ACC, and it was kind of a breakthrough in many ways, but they still sort of fell apart at the end. They got killed at Georgia Tech. They got killed at NC State. They got killed at South Carolina. And then, of course, the 70 spot against West Virginia. So there's all this negativity
right.
swirling around. People talking about, on message boards at least, talking about, got to fire Joey Batson. You got to fire Robbie Caldwell, this and that. And, boy, you weren't here at that time, but Dabo came in, like, breathing fire at his postseason wrap-up, and it was really just a defense of his program, a defense of what they were doing. And I'm just speculating here. Maybe Brownell was taking a bit of a page from that book.
I think that's fair, and, you know, he pointed out that they made the Sweet 16 last year and won 20 games again this year, and, you know, he feels good about some pieces that they have coming in. So I think his point was basically, you know, he's kind of getting beat up a little bit when you get on social media and that kind of stuff, and some fans' message boards aren't really thrilled with what happened this year. And his point is that, you know, we've got a pretty good team, a pretty good program. We've done some good things, and maybe people aren't looking at the whole picture, the renovations that have happened to Little John, kind of everything that he's done with the program, other than just maybe just missing out on the NCAA tournament this year.
But it was an extremely frustrating and disappointing season. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, it was. I mean, when you look at going into the year, I think pretty much everyone thought that this was a team that could get back to the NCAA tournament, and, you know, they were going to have to have some breaks to maybe get to the Sweet 16 again, but for whatever reason, it just didn't all come together. And he mentioned, you know, Shelton Mitchell having, I think, a bone in his knee, a small bone that was kind of roaming around in there some, and how that really hurt him this year. And, you know, I think that's fair. I mean, they had their point guard who was expected to be top three player, maybe second best player behind Marquise, was never really healthy. So definitely not the season that they were hoping to have, and I'm sure he's frustrated as well with the way kind of everything went.
You know, another point, I mean, it seems like a long time ago now, but just a year ago, they're coming off one of the best seasons in school history, Sweet 16. And so maybe it was also a bit of that, you know, it's like, hey, you know, Sweet 16s are not easy to come by here. Right. And we got to that. And so now he's facing, but I haven't seen a ton of, I mean, beyond message board factions and stuff like that. I mean, it's not like he's getting hammered by the local media or anything like that. I mean, the football is on the brain of everybody right now with Sweeney's program doing what it's doing. So in many ways, that's kind of been overshadowed by just the enormousness of what football's doing.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen, you know, I've gone on a couple of radio shows and have heard guys have tried to tell me, you know, I think Brownell should be gone. What do you think? And that kind of stuff. So, I mean, I've seen it a little bit in the media, but as far as the people that are here every day that are kind of really covering the program, you know, definitely no columns kind of saying it's time for him to go or anything like that, that I've seen. And I really don't think that that's fair at this point. I mean, for the points that he made today, you know, I really don't think it's time for a change right now.
All right. Big shift in gears. What's your story? You started covering Clemson in, I guess, around 15, right? I think that's when we first met at the Orange Bowl, maybe, Oklahoma.
Yeah, I covered the first year they went to the playoff. I came in kind of halfway through that season. So, yeah, that would have been 2015. I got hired at the state newspaper in the start of that year, and they kind of switched me over from South Carolina coverage halfway through the year as Clemson kept getting better and better and moving up the rankings, and they kind of realized holy cow, that team's got a chance to really do something special this year. And they had some freelancers up here working, but not a full-time staff person. And I was living in Spartanburg at the time and still live there, kind of where I was born and raised and kind of been there my whole life. So it was kind of natural to send me up here, and it's been a lot of fun kind of following the program ever since.
So you grew up in Spartanburg. You worked for the Spartanburg Herald Journal at one point, didn't you?
I did, yeah. So I started off freelance writing for the Herald Journal in college. And I thought I wanted to be a teacher, and both of my parents were teachers, and they kind of told me how much it was changing, and they weren't sure it was the right profession to go into. And so I had grown up always following sports and kind of wanting to be a sports writer. Read Eric Boynton and Todd Shaughnessy and Jason Gilmer and some of those guys in the Herald Journal coming up. And for whatever reason, I kind of gave up on that dream a little bit, decided I was going to try education, and then ended up switching to journalism. Just talked to Jason Gilmer and said, you know, this is really my dream and my passion. He was a long-time high school writer there at the Herald Journal. And so I got into freelance writing with them when I was in college some, and ended up getting a full-time job a couple years after college working with them.
It's funny you say your parents were in education and they sort of tried to dissuade you from going that route. Had they been in newspapers, they probably would have dissuaded you from going that route and said, yeah, you need to go into teaching.
Yeah, that's fair. But, you know, they kind of always were, go wherever your heart is, go with whatever your dream is. And growing up, I just always loved sports. And, you know, number one dream was to play professional sports. And I realized at about age 12 when I was doing okay on the All-Star Little League baseball team, but that was about it. And I wasn't really growing. I'm about 5'7 or so that probably wasn't going to get it done in the NBA. So I just, for whatever reason, felt like, you know, I really love sports. I wanted to find something that I could do, being around it all the time. And so my parents, you know, I know the newspaper business wasn't great or isn't great and was kind of already starting on the downslide then a little bit as far as stability and that kind of stuff. But, you know, it was my passion, and my parents kind of said, go follow your dream, follow what you want to do, and go for it. So I wouldn't change anything with the way it's worked out. You know, I love my job and consider myself blessed to do what I do.
So USC Upstate, did they have any sort of communications or intro to journalism, anything like that?
They did, yeah. I mean, we had a journalism classes. It probably wasn't, you know, what you would typically get. It may be a large school. You know, we had some pretty tough classes, and we had some classes where we had to write stories, and my story could be, I wrote this freelance piece for the newspaper, and they would say, oh, well, God, you already write for the newspaper. That sounds like an A to me, and I could just, you know, turn in a freelance article or something like that. So it was a different experience. I definitely, you know, enjoyed my time at Upstate and learned a good bit, but I think more than anything I learned just being in college and going out and, you know, getting into the field and doing freelance work, covering high school football, covering high school volleyball, high school soccer, that kind of stuff, really helped me a lot as far as learning how you have to go out and track the stats. And, you know, you don't have an SID or stat broadcast or anything like that to kind of keep you updated. You kind of have to do all of those roles. So kind of learning that way, I think, really helped me.
That's the really fascinating thing about media, sports writing, whatever, is there's no, like, boilerplate route to doing it. There's right. No standard. Like, I mean, you have your great journalism schools like, you know, North Carolina, South Carolina, Missouri, whatever, Northwestern. And there are some great, you know, distinguished journalists that have come out of those schools and others. But you also have some great journalists who have not even come close to stepping foot in a journalism school. And they've just started working at papers, freelancing. And then you have some really bad ones who have come out of the best journalism schools that exist.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you can write, you can write, and people are going to find you, or you're going to be able to send them clips, and they're going to appreciate kind of the work that you've done, whether you went to, like I did, USC Upstate, or you went to Northwestern or Syracuse or somewhere like that. You know, I think it really just matters kind of what your skill is, what you're able to do, more so than maybe where you went to school and that kind of stuff.
Okay, so at some point, okay, you went from writing for the Spartanburg paper to doing that, was it the Fox affiliate?
Right, yeah, I worked for Fox Carolina for a summer as a photographer, and so I was at the Herald Journal for a couple years, and a new company came in, Gatehouse came in and bought the Herald Journal, and one of the first things they did was lay off a few of the new hire employees, and they kind of created a position for me at the time to cover South Carolina, and there weren't a whole lot of positions being created in newspapers at that time, and so I got cut, and I had interviewed with Fox Carolina for actually a web producer job, and before that, because I kind of, it would have been a nice pay raise, and I could kind of feel things maybe not going great at the Herald Journal, and there were some rumblings that there could be layoffs, and they called me back and said, well, we don't have a web producer job, but we have a job as a photographer, and I said, well, I've never picked up a camera before in my life, other than if you count the cell phone, So they said, well, just think about it and let us know. And so I was like, yeah, I mean, it's you know, a job, but I'd rather stay at the Herald Journal right now and take my chances. And I think the next day or a couple of days later, I got laid off. And so I called and said, actually, that job sounds perfect. That's just what I wanted to do. Let's do it. So I did that for 3 months or so, and it was different. It was good to kind of get that experience. You know, it's different going from covering sports and doing that all the time to getting a phone call and there's a triple homicide in Greenville that you need to go and interview witnesses about, or, you know, a guy that burned in his car and you're trying to interview his mom and talk to him after it. It's good to kind of get those experiences. It kind of made me appreciate more of what I had when I was at the Herald Journal and kind of really why I got into the business. I just don't think it was something that I could do long term. You know, I was working 60 hours a week and kind of doing some things that, covering some things that I wasn't really used to having to cover as far as murders and shootings and that kind of stuff. And so, you know, it was tough on me at times for sure. I mean, my wife said that I became kind of negative, and she could tell it was kind of beating me up, and so it was maybe time to get out, and thankfully the state had an opening and ended up giving me a shot.
So this was all straight news, no sports?
Yeah, I did a little bit of sports. I covered Wofford in the NCAA tournament. They were actually in Jacksonville that year. I went down and did a few days down there with them. I covered South Carolina women in the Final Four. Aaron Cheslock, who's the sports anchor, the head sports guy at Fox Carolina, when he got me hired, and he played a big role, and I really appreciated him helping to get me hired. But when we did that, he was going to try to do as much sports as possible, but it was the summer, so, you know, there's not a whole lot going on, no football season. Basketball season was just finishing up, and, you know, no teams made it to Omaha from South Carolina that year, so there wasn't a whole lot of sports. And so I did as much sports as I could, and they sent to me as much sports as they could. But the majority of it was hard news.
And then how did you hook up with the state? Did you have a relationship with the folks down there?
Yeah. I mean, I knew some of those guys just from being at games. I covered South Carolina for, the Herald Journal. So I had a bit of a relationship. And you know, I applied for a job. They had a job covering South Carolina baseball and South Carolina football. And so I applied and got an interview, and, you know, I guess things worked out well. It was funny, when I got hired, we had planned on moving to Columbia, my wife and I, and we were getting ready. We had actually already put our house on the market and we're getting ready to move down. And my wife found out she was pregnant. And so our family's here, her family's here. They're both sets of parents are retired. And so having daycare and that kind of stuff was going to be a big cost. And just being able to have hands here, because, you know, my wife's in retail and I'm working as a sports writer, so I'm gone all the time. And it would have been a big help to have them around. So we had already put our house on the market, and our house had actually sold the day I got, or right around when I got offered the job at the state. And so we ended up staying in the upstate. The state was gracious enough to let me stay up here and kind of just commute for a while. And so the first couple years when I was covering South Carolina baseball and then South Carolina football for at least a few months. Did a lot of commuting. I think I could go down I-26 with my eyes closed, just going back and forth.
How far is that?
It's about an hour and a half from where I live in Spartanburg. So, you know, Clemson's right around an hour, a little over an hour. But, you know, that 30 minutes both ways really makes a big difference.
And so you with Spartanburg, what was the time frame that you covered South Carolina football?
It was towards the end with Spurrier. I kind of had the good years with Spurrier there. It would have been 2000, I guess the first game I covered, because I remember it was Marcus Lattimore's, I think, second or third game, maybe his third game. They were playing Furman, and it was kind of Marcus Lattimore was starting to introduce himself, and he was a Spartanburg guy, and so they said, well, why don't you go down there and write a story on Marcus? And that was when I was still freelancing. The guy, I think I covered every game after that through my time with the Herald Journal. So that would have been 2010, 2011, 2012, 2013, and maybe even 2014 as well.
You know, at least from my perspective, it wasn't easy to see the collapse coming.
Right.
Like until it was right in front of you.
Right.
Is that the same with you? And when did you first start to think, you know, this might not last and it might get bad in a hurry?
It was definitely the Texas A&M game that first year. I think they were coming off an 11-win season and they had a lot to replace in the secondary that year. They had several guys that had moved on and Clowney was gone and no, we knew that the defense had some question marks, but they were still favored against Texas A&M. I think they were top 10, top 15, something like that. And Kevin Sumlin and that team came into town. And, I mean, you could just tell early on, South Carolina had no shot. Like, I mean, they were just they could have had 1,000 yards that day probably if they wanted to. It was kind of like the Clemson game this year with Clemson's offense against South Carolina where you could just tell pretty early on that everything they were trying was working. You know, they had receivers running wide open all over the field. And South Carolina had signed some pretty highly rated defensive backs for that class that they were kind of counting on right away. And you could just tell that it wasn't going to happen.
And, so, I mean, you follow recruiting a lot more than I do. Was it just a case of, like you mentioned, that you had some highly rated defensive backs, and then you just assume that, well, they've been recruiting well this whole time, and so it's going to continue just because they're on this sort of cruise control, I guess. Was it a case of only, I guess, in hindsight, you realized based on Steve Spurrier's own admissions that he had just sort of fallen asleep at the wheel in recruiting? Like, you start hearing in successive years after that, like Nick Chubb coming to campus, right, and Spurrier wasn't even there, and Raekwon McMillan didn't know his name or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you heard a lot of instances like that where they just – I'm not going to say he was asleep at the wheel, but in some ways I think he was. I mean, there were times when guys would show up, and like you said, Spurrier wouldn't be there, and guys, highly rated five-star players, would come up and introduce themselves, and he'd say, what's your name again, and that kind of stuff. You know, J.J. Arcega-Whiteside was a receiver – from Dorman, who will be a pretty high draft pick in the NFL this year. And he went, and I've kind of heard from talking to some people over that Dorman that they didn't really pay him much attention when he was down there on a visit. He never got an offer or anything. And so you started hearing more and more stories like that. I actually did a story shortly after the new staff at South Carolina was hired where I talked to high school coaches kind of anonymously around the state about how things changed under Muschamp compared to Spurrier at the end. And they said, you know, Jeff Scott comes in, he knows every high school coach in the state. They said, if you text him, he'll text you back within 5 minutes. I mean, he's just great about knowing everybody, having those connections, and that there were times when you wouldn't see a South Carolina coach for several months at a time, whereas Jeff is there all the time. I mean, I know that, you know, I think Clemson staff makes sure that it goes around to every school in the state, whether it's a 1A school or a 5A school, you know, whether they have no prospects at all or the best prospect in the country, they're going to be there because they want to start building those connections early on. And I think South Carolina staff does that more now, and you're seeing them have a little more success with that. But that at the end of the Spurrier era, some of it was Spurrier, some of it was assistants. For whatever reason, they just really kind of lagged off on that and didn't do nearly as much of that kind of building the connections at the high school level where it all really starts.
I think you have one faction of Gamecock fans that say, screw Spurrier, he left us in the ditch, don't want to have anything to do with him. Then another says, you know, 11 wins 3 years in a row, never been done, you know, 5 wins over Clemson. What is the proper take on his legacy, in your opinion?
I think South Carolina fans should be thankful for I think it's okay to be thankful for the time that they had with Spurrier and very thankful for kind of everything he did with those 11 win seasons and the memories that they made and all that kind of stuff, beating Clemson 5 times in a row, all that kind of stuff, but also be a little frustrated with the way it ended where it kind of got so bad so quickly. But at the same time, I mean, you know, that program now is back to kind of 6-6, 7-5, which is what it's really been for a long time. And so I think when you have a person that's able to come in and elevate it the way he did and win an SEC East title and win 5 in a row against Clemson and win, and you know, those were pretty good Clemson teams he was beating too. I mean, it wasn't 3-8, 3-9 Clemson teams. He was beating some pretty good Clemson teams as well. So I think you need to appreciate what he's done. But also I can understand some that are frustrated with kind of how it ended.
It's really fascinating. You mentioned, you know, 7-5, whatever, is about – that's pretty good, you know, for their history. Mm-hmm. But historically, they haven't had to confront this monster that exists right now in the upstate, you know, in their state, and then the monster that exists in their division, Georgia, over in Athens.
Right.
How has Clemson's ascendance or whatever to – this type of the class of college football, has that affected the psyche, not only the psyche of the fans down there, but also how they evaluate or how they measure what's a successful season?
Yeah, I think there's definitely some frustration there. You know, my suggestion for South Carolina fans would kind of be just focus on your team, be kind of happy when you get good recruits and be happy when you win games and that kind of stuff, and try to tune out Clemson and Georgia right now because they're just at another level from where South Carolina is in recruiting and on the field and championships, that kind of stuff. And so, you know, I think if you get caught up in what Clemson's doing and what Georgia's doing and the playoff appearances and all of that kind of stuff, you're going to just really be frustrated. So, you know, my suggestion would be patient with Muschamp, kind of be happy when you get big time recruits. And they've started recruiting a little better under him. They got Zach Pickens last year and a few other guys that I know that they really wanted. So that would be my suggestion, is just kind of be focused on your own program right now and try not to pay too much attention to Clemson and Georgia. As hard as that is to do with where they are, and at least until you get to a point where you can be more competitive on the field with those teams.
In a state of 4 million people, is it possible for South Carolina to achieve major success while Clemson has such a big piece of the pie and while Georgia, you know, your border state, the most important border state, has such right. a big piece of the market share, I guess, for lack of a better word, over there?
I think in some ways Clemson's national recruiting and what they're doing right now helps South Carolina just because South Carolina is having more success getting the players that it wants in the state because Clemson's able to go to California or Texas or Florida or wherever and get the best player there, that South Carolina is able to maybe attract a higher level of prospect here.
Big supporter of the podcast and bigger supporter of Clemson Athletics and Clemson University is Harris Flooring America, based in Anderson, South Carolina. And they've got their footprint, I guess you could say, all over the upstate, all over Clemson. They have done work for BMW, the football operations facility, otherwise known as Dabo Land, Memorial Stadium, the Neary Center, the Greenville Drive, and of late, the McFadden Building, getting a much-needed renovation that includes some pristine flooring from Harris Flooring America. They have been family-owned and operated since 1947. The owner, Scott Junkins, is a big Clemson guy. He employs Clemson folks. They offer a unique shopping experience through value in their services, developing the right product solutions for your home or business, and delivering on their promises. And can't emphasize that enough, even though it named a lot of businesses. They also serve the residential segments. For homeowners, Harris offers floor-to-ceiling design capabilities as well. So give them a call, 864-642-6183, or online at flooringamerica-anderson.com.
All right, so in 2015, when you started covering Clemson, you didn't transition exclusively to Clemson. You were still covering South Carolina baseball. Is that correct?
Right. So I was here during football season for Clemson for every game the second half of the year, kind of when they realized how good they were. And then I was going down in baseball season, and I was the South Carolina beat writer. And South Carolina baseball fans really care about baseball, and that's really a full-time job. You know, I was there every weekend, every midweek game. I traveled some. I went to Nashville for a series. I went to Knoxville for a series. I really kind of dove in head first, and there's enough attention down there on baseball and enough support and people that care that that was really a full-time job. So it was a lot for sure, but it was fun.
Beyond the workload, we've talked about this before. People draw their own lines. Fans make up their own minds about perceived biases and this and that. When you're covering both teams, I'm sure you're getting some flack from both sides.
Yeah, and it's fun. I mean, you get called a Clemson homer, who's a stupid coot lover. Or I'm sorry, a Clemson homer who's a tater one day and a coot lover the next day. And I don't know. I just always take it and run with it and laugh with it, or laugh at it. I enjoy the back and forth. If you follow me on Twitter, I love kind of interacting with people and have fun with it. So I don't ever really take offense to any of that kind of stuff. I just kind of enjoy it and play along with it.
Were you saying that a couple of Gamecock baseball players even mentioned something on Twitter or something to you about it?
Well, so I got done covering Clemson the year that they went to the national championship for the first time against Alabama. And then I guess a month later or so, I went down for baseball preseason interviews. And, yeah, some of the guys were saying, oh, what's up, man? I didn't know you were allowed around here anymore. I thought you were all Clemson now, the Clemson lover. And so, yeah, those guys would give me a hard time. And a few of them told me their families had all unfollowed me on Twitter because they couldn't take it anymore because all I did was tweet about Clemson. So, yeah, but those guys were a lot of fun. I still talk to a couple of those guys now. I mean, it was a fun team to cover and a fun group to be around.
We've talked about this before. Like, if only people knew, like, you know, how, I guess, cold and soulless we are as far as, like after a game, it's not like we walk out of there pumping our fists if the team will cover and
win.
Well, some of us aren't.
That's true. You and I aren't.
Yeah.
A few others.
A few others definitely are, and they're doing it during the game. And if they lose, it's not like we're going home all depressed and beating our dogs or anything. Like, win or lose, I mean, when I walk out of the press box, I mean, yeah, I'm thinking about the game, you know, right. Obsessing about, okay, you know, what happened here? Why did this happen? But that's for the purposes of what am I going to write, you know, tomorrow morning. But, you know, my first quest is to, you know, find a beer and sit down and right. Watch some college football. You know, like a normal person.
Yeah, I mean, the only team I really care about is in any sport really right now is just Purdue, and that's just because my mom went there. She grew up a mile from the campus. Her whole family went there. My grandparents went there. You know, I grew up going to games and that kind of stuff. So I'm passionate about Purdue. I root for Purdue. But other than that, no, I just I don't know. I really it's hard for me to get it, like how you can try to cover a team fairly and rationally and have an opinion one way or another as a fan or anything, because you're going to get too high with the highs and too low with the lows. And I just don't think it's really hard to do your job if you're like a diehard fan, I think, and do it the way you need to do it.
Not asking you to call anybody out or anything, but what is your take on the Clemson beat relative to what we're talking about with the whole sort of fanboy element?
Yeah, I think in some ways it gets a bad rep just because, I mean, there are definitely some people that are fans and that, you know, do kind of live and die with the team and stuff. But I also think that there are a lot of really good reporters on this beat that do a really good job, that write really good stories, and that have fair and accurate takes. And so when, you know, sometimes people lump Clemson media all together as kind of one group with a negative negative annotation, I don't really think that that's fair to kind of group everyone together. You know, I think that there's a lot of really good work that gets done on this beat, and a lot of really good people, and a lot of people I consider friends. So I don't know. I think judging everybody as kind of one group, it can be unfair.
Is there a similar dynamic like on the South Carolina beat of kind of sunshine guys or rah-rah fan types?
I don't think it's as bad there, or maybe as many people, but there are definitely, you know, just like here and just like a lot of places, there are definitely people that cover the team that also kind of root for them very hard, and maybe not to the extent, I don't think, that it is here, and not maybe as many people, but there are some, yeah, there as well.
When you have those types of – that type of presence among the credentialed media, in what way does that sort of keep you from doing your job, or like affect how you do your job?
I try not to let it affect me as much as possible. I kind of just try to do my job the best that I can. And, you know, I guess the hard part sometimes is there are so many people there that it's hard to get maybe one-on-one interviews or exclusive stuff, or maybe really spend as much time with one person or one player or one coach or whatever that you would like. But I kind of try to just do my own thing and kind of just do my job the best I can with what's given. And I do think, you know, I will say this about Clemson and kind of the media setup. I like it a lot better than at South Carolina, where no freshmen are available. You don't get coordinators at all during the season. Just about every press conference, at least when I was there, was done. Every media availability was done in a press conference setting. There was no grabbing guys to the side or that kind of stuff. So overall, I really think Clemson does a pretty good job with the way it handles the media. And I think it's, from talking to other writers around the country, I think it's better than a lot of places.
What was it like for you when you first started covering Clemson? You live how far away?
About an hour.
Yeah, so you're not like here every single day, and you know, you're trying to ingratiate yourself, you're trying to learn and tell good stories and all that. Was that difficult at all at the beginning?
It was hard going back and forth, because, you know, I felt like football season would end, and then I wasn't even here much for the spring, the first year or two, and so I felt like I was behind in some ways, and it was kind of hard trying to figure out what's a story, what's not a story. You know, if somebody reports something, am I supposed to try to taste that at Clemson, or am I just supposed to worry about South Carolina at the time? So that part was kind of difficult, just not being around as much, not kind of building connections, getting to know people, that kind of stuff. You know, it's definitely more enjoyable, I think, and easier in some ways to only be at one school where you can, whether it be here or South Carolina, where you can really kind of get to know the SIDs, the coaches, the players, all of that, all of those kind of people that you need to have relationships with at a different level.
When did you get the feeling that Clemson football and Dabo, that it was more than just a Deshaun, Mike Williams, Jordan Leggett sort of culmination of stars aligning with this generational talent this one year where they can outlast a great Alabama team and win with a second left, that it's beyond that and something where you're, you know, multiple 2, 3, 4 national titles perhaps over a, I don't know, 6, 7 year period might be realistic?
Well, we had that conversation, I think, in the old room at Clemson where we used to do interviews, where we set up at Death Valley. I remember the end of the 2015 season, I guess, and said, so what do you think next year? Do you think, and I think we both probably said they weren't making the playoff, I don't think.
Yeah,
we
had. Right.
I mean, I think I thought they would maybe go 8-4, 9-3 the next year. You know, we didn't know much about, you know, you're right. At that point, I did think a lot of it was Deshaun and Mike and these guys, and that when they left, Clemson was going to take a step back and kind of go back to where they were until maybe they got another generational talent like they have now with Trevor Lawrence. But I guess with Kelly and what he did last year, you know, I think that season really proved that Clemson's here to stay. I mean, Kelly Bryant wasn't the number one quarterback in the country. He was a good player at Clemson, but he wasn't a necessarily generational talent. And so I think that when they did what they did and had the success that they did, and you saw them kind of adapt the offense to where he was running more and he was probably a better runner than Deshaun was in some ways. And so I think when you saw them have the success that they were with Kelly, continue to go back to the playoff, be the number one team entering the playoff that year, win the ACC again, that's when you're kind of like, holy cow, they're going to be really good for a long time.
Still, though, getting back to the playoff in 17 without Deshaun and with Kelly Bryant, extraordinary accomplishment. Beating Alabama by 4 touchdowns, mind-blowing accomplishment. Like, yeah. Was it, I guess, with me at least, it was during that game when it was like, holy crap, this is like, you know, they're not just, you know, playing with Alabama and hoping to win at the end. Right. They're destroying these guys, and now it just seems like a whole different ball game in terms of expectations.
Well, I think they're at level. So I think the first year that made me kind of take a step was seeing what Kelly did and saying, yeah, this team's here to stay. The level that made me say, holy cow, this is the best team and program in the country right now is what you mentioned with the championship game. And speaking of conversations we had, I think we both thought going into that game that Alabama was going to win, or it was going to be really, really close, because we weren't sure Clemson could block them, and we weren't sure secondary wise that they were ready to cover those receivers, and we could not have been more wrong. So yeah, I mean, you're sitting there during that game and Alabama's offense is kind of muddling around and not doing much, and Justin Ross is making one-handed catches all over the place, and Trevor Lawrence is showing the same poise he did all year, and you've got T. Higgins, you know, making catches, Travis Etienne running through defenders, and you're just like, and we haven't even talked about the defense and those guys yet. And so, yeah, I mean, that game definitely made me realize, you know, this program's on its way in the right direction, and it's already at the top. So, yeah, just that was an incredible performance.
Yeah, I mean, talking with a number of people who cover Clemson going into that game, I can't think of one person, and I'm talking about like 8 or 10 people.
Right.
I can't think of one person who said, I kind of like Clemson's chances in this one. It was, it seemed like everybody was virtually unanimous, including multiple people from a website that shall go unnamed, all said, yeah, I think Alabama's going to win. And then their predictions came out and they unanimously said Clemson. Did I say they all said Alabama was going to win, and their predictions were unanimously in favor of Clemson. It just yeah, it felt like if Clemson won, it was going to be close, and if it was going to be a blowout, it was going to be Alabama doing the sure. ass kicking.
And the thing I remember most about that week was all the national writers were kind of more on Clemson's
That's
side.
Right.
Like a lot of those guys thought that Clemson was going to win, or that they at least had a really good chance. And after the game, talking with a few of those guys, they said, yeah, I think you guys were so close to Clemson all year and kind of so focused on them that you only paid attention to the flaws that they had and didn't realize that Alabama had some flaws too that Clemson was able to expose, and they did in a big way. I mean, you know, we didn't think Clemson could cover Alabama, but Alabama had no shot covering those Clemson receivers. I mean, they just made plays all over the field, and obviously most of those guys are coming back.
Yeah, I mean, like with the offensive line blocking Alabama's defensive line, I'm not really kicking myself over not envisioning that, because right. like who would have envisioned that? Because that same Alabama defensive line, you know, without Quinnen Williams,
right,
abused Clemson's offensive line the year before in New Orleans. What I do kick myself over is not making enough of Christian Wilkins, Cleveland Farrell, and Austin Bryant coming back.
Yeah.
And the reason they came back and the all-consuming drive and determination they had to close the deal
And as Cleland says, to finish the job, it's like his immortal quote about it's like going number two and not wiping. He used to have a bad feeling. I'll never forget that one. But man, that's a huge. That wasn't the only difference, but that's a massive difference when you have that kind of determination. From similar with Deshaun Watson and Mike Williams, they were going through it their last times. Wayne Gallman, Jordan Leggett, like. That's enough to push you through.
And going into the year, you know, talking, and we go over to Dabo's dinner or house and have dinner with him, and he was pretty open, like, this team's going to be really freaking good. I don't think any of us knew how good they were going to be, but he was pretty open about at the time that, yeah, this is the most depth that we've ever had. This is the best team that we've had. Now, they've got to go out and do it, but talent-wise, this is the best one that we've had. And they had the leadership, they had everything to go with it, with Christian, with Cleland, with Austin, with Kendall Joseph, all those guys. Yeah, just talking about – so I have a – my favorite show is watching SVP Sports Center, so I was watching – I'm like 40 episodes behind, still watching, but I watch them on DVR.
Really? You watch Sports Center? You
just the SVP. I love the bad beat segment, cracks me up and that kind of stuff. And so anyway, the one with Clemson winning the title was on the other day, and it was funny going back and watching those guys do the wet willy after. And but one thing, Cleland, you can see him on the stand after the game, goes, you know, they were supposed to be the best ever, and we beat the beep bleep bleep out of them. and you know, you can just see that those guys, maybe we all didn't see it, we all kind of thought Alabama was going to win, but those guys were super confident going into the game and really wanted to make a statement that they were the best team ever and that they were tired of the hype and all the talk about Alabama. And I think Dabo is the master at kind of doing that kind of stuff as far as getting the team focused and motivated and you know, yeah, this is the narrative. Let's go prove them wrong. And I'm interested to see how he's going to do that this year with a team that's going to probably be number one by a lot of people, but he'll find a way, I'm sure.
Hey, and there are people out there who are giving him ways to do it, and he has to love it because assorted people out there, you know, Alabama was fatigued through that brutal SEC schedule. And
I mean, if the game's played maybe the week after the SEC championship and they've played like eight games in a row or something, you know, you can maybe go with that when you have a month off and give me a break.
You know, clickbait headlines of Clemson is throwing shade on Alabama by having best ever on the championship rings. It's like, wait a minute. So if the roles would have been reversed and Alabama won that game by four touchdowns and had best ever on its championship rings, how many people out there would be saying they're throwing shade on Clemson? And really, and furthermore, I guess more for the purposes of this particular topic, like you're seeing people still picking Alabama number one going into the year. It's not overwhelming, but there are still people doing it. And again, had the roles been reversed and Alabama, if they were coming off a four touchdown national championship win, how many people would be, it'd be universal, universally Alabama. And so I think Dabo still has plenty of fodder. And actually on that Van Pelt show, what the part that stands out to me is, I mean, Dabo was salty after that game.
He was. He was salty even in his press conference here. Everybody's talking about Alabama, what happened to Alabama. I'll tell you what happened. We beat the crap out of him. That's basically what he said.
And he's like, Dabo says, y'all media, you know, everybody's talking about this and that. And Van Pelt says, well, that wasn't me. And Dabo says, oh, no, all y'all were saying it. And so you just got a sense of, you know, in 16 when they won it, it was like a magical, like, answered prayer. It's the first time, and they're emotional. Whereas this time, man, there's this defiant sort of I think they have some swagger now because they know how good they have been. They know how good they are, and they know how good they're going to continue to be.
Yeah, and I mean, I said after the game, and I'll go ahead and give a spoiler alert on my predictions that I do before every game. I'm not going to pick Trevor Lawrence to lose another game as long as he's here. I mean, he's so good. He's so calm. He's so good in these big games. And to do what he did as a freshman against Alabama, and I know maybe it wasn't the best secondary that they've had, but Yeah, I mean, he's just so good, and they have so many good receivers around him. I mean, you saw what Ngata and Ladson did this weekend in the spring game. It's just incredible the talent that they have and kind of how he's able to get the ball to those guys. But going back to Dabo for a second, it's still kind of funny to me because he was kind of at the front all along of like the – oh man, we're just happy to be riding along. You know, we're in the rest of y'all bus, and he said that when the first playoff rankings came out. And I know that some of that was kind of being tongue in cheek, but he definitely said he thought Alabama. He would say publicly at the time, and I'm sure he wasn't telling his team that, but he would go on TV and kind of help build the narrative as well. That oh yeah, Alabama, they're a whole nother league from us. You know, we don't belong in that conversation. So I don't know. He's a master at doing that kind of stuff.
He knows exactly what he's doing.
Right.
And yeah, you know, this program, you know, always rails against disrespect. But then on the other hand, on people not, you know, giving them their proper due.
Right.
But then on the other hand, you hear Dabo talk about last summer when he had a preview, you know, the latest in a long line of preview magazines that wanted to put those defensive linemen on the cover. They wanted to do a photo shoot. Right. He was angry. No more cover shoots. No more of this. Too much of a distraction.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like I said, he's just the master at kind of motivating and what you mentioned, knowing exactly what to say to kind of get his team ready. And so, you know, I'm sure it'd be fascinating to kind of sit and be in the pregame speech and that kind of stuff and hear what he's telling his team, as opposed to kind of what he's telling us about how we're just kind of happy to be included in the conversation.
And also interesting was something he revealed, I think, in the post game press conference that night, was like halfway through the year. He told his team, y'all are the best team in the country.
Yeah.
Y'all just don't know it yet. And so, whereas in the moment during the regular season, when he's asked about, you know, questions here and there about Alabama, he's like, well, I ain't paying any attention to that. Yeah. he's watching them when he gets home at night, and he's keeping score and sort of measuring strengths versus strengths and weaknesses and all that.
Yeah, he definitely is. And I remember before the first title game that they won, kind of waiting when the buses pulled up in Tampa, and Dabo standing up and giving a speech for about, I don't know, 30, 45 seconds or something. You could see him pretty fired up in the bus, and they got off the bus, and you could just see they were locked in. So I don't know what he said, but he's just, I think he's the best motivator in the game right now. I mean, I think the job that he does getting his team ready to play is incredible, and they're ready to play every week. I mean, it doesn't matter if they're playing Furman or South Carolina State or playing Alabama, Auburn, you know, whoever. They're ready to go every week, and it's incredible kind of the consistency and the way that they have built this program to where every time the ball snapped, they're ready to go.
Over the next 5 years, how many more national titles does Clemson win?
Oh, I think if I was setting an over-under, I'd probably do 2.5. Like, and it'd be hard for me to decide.
The fact that that's the over-under is pretty nuts, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think when I say that I think Trevor will win the next two with Clemson, I mean, that's, you know, I really wouldn't be surprised at all if they win these next two. And then they got another top quarterback in the country likely coming in a couple years. And I don't know. I think they're going to keep the ball rolling. They're recruiting right there with Alabama right now. And their staff, top to bottom, I mean, you can make an argument, Dabo or Saban or whatever, but top to bottom, I think Clemson staff, with the continuity that they've had with Venables and Jeff Scott and Tony Elliott and all those guys, that it's hard to argue that staff's not better than Alabama's right now, and that you would believe in it more than you would Alabama right now. So I'd probably set it at 2.5, and it'd be hard not to go over.
Is there anybody that's ready to break the stranglehold, this Clemson-Alabama monopoly?
Yeah, I thought Georgia was, and then you see what happened with them and against Texas, and you just kind of wonder if they really have the maturity and that kind of stuff to be ready to take that next level and be that kind of a program. You know, speaking of Texas, I think Texas is a program that's on the way up with Tom Herman there. In the ACC, it's really hard to find anybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, Florida State just the first year with Taggart was pretty much a disaster. I mean, I didn't think that he was a great choice when you looked at his overall record, and I know he had started with some tough places to win at, but I still wasn't completely sold on that for a program like Florida State, and his first year was a real struggle. So that would be the program that you would always think, just because of how well they recruit, that they're going to be able to give Clemson somewhat of a challenge in the ACC, but it's hard to really see anybody right now in the league kind of playing with them.
Matt Connelly of the State, anything we haven't covered that you want to talk about?
No, I don't think so. Just enjoyed being on and really appreciate you having me, and enjoy your work. Really excited to read the rest of this Brent Venables series.
Yeah, thank you. I know you listen to the Dubcast at times, so really appreciate that.
Yep, it's a lot of fun and honored to be a guest.
Thank you, Matt.
All right, thanks to Matt Connelly of the State for joining us. Really fun conversation there. Thanks to the Abernathy Boutique Hotel for being such a great host, as always. Our title sponsor, of course, is Parham Smith and Arts and Hull Law Firm. Also, Tandem Payment. Both of those sponsors, Greenville-based. And in Anderson is Harris Flooring America. Really appreciate the support of all of our sponsors, without which this most certainly would not be possible. Mostly, though, thanks to all of you for making this a part of your weekly listening routine. We'll be back next week. Everybody have a great rest of the week this week and weekend, and we'll talk to you later. Cheers.